Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. David Porter in this episode. David is CEO of eCampus Ontario. He has a practitioner's experience as an early enthusiast of using technology in the classroom, and his innovative work now sees him heading a government-funded agency with a particular focus on the development of OER. David and I talked via Skype. Well, it's my privilege to be talking with Dr. David Porter, who is Chief Executive Officer of eCampus Ontario, which is funded by the Government of Ontario to be a centre of excellence in online and technology-enabled learning for all publicly funded colleges and universities of that region. David, it's wonderful to be talking with you.
Thanks, Mark. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Brilliant. Well, should we get started with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Yeah, I think I'm probably somewhat different from many of the people you may speak to in online education because my career has been primarily as a practitioner, and I've come to research late in my career and started my work in elementary school education and graduated from there to become a master teacher, what's known as a faculty associate, in a teaching program at Simon Fraser University that was a teacher education program, and moved from there to working with technology and introducing teachers in the late 80s, early 90s to the opportunities and implications of using technology-enabled learning in classrooms. Mm. And my career began to kind of take different directions after that, including university teaching and some consulting work and some research with a research and development agency that was based in Vancouver, British Columbia, called NUMIC, the New Media Information Center. And so I've had a whole series of careers that have allowed me to be at the startup, at the front end of interesting ideas that we're looking to scale in the education space and the technology-enabled education space. So I can say more, but that's kind of how I got my start.
Great. Please do say more. I mean, the 80s and 90s were very early days.
They were. I mean, one of the most interesting projects that I worked on in the 90s was called New Directions in Distance Learning, which was a basic education, K-12 education, as it's called in North America. And we were servicing remote, rural, one-room and two-room schools in northern British Columbia using telepresence and discussion boards and synchronous teaching using really low-bandwidth video in those days and audio teleconferencing. And so I think that many of the things that you see now around teaching with technology at a distance using desk-based video conferencing and telepresence tools to do demonstrations and whiteboarding activities really got their start in those days. And we tested many of those things out with high school students who had no real opportunity to take a senior mathematics course or a chemistry course or a physics course. And we had a cadre of instructors who were willing to try that out. And some of those rural one-room schools graduated their first high school students ever as a result of that program. So I knew then the potential was going to just take off from there as the technology evolved and got more robust.
Mm, fantastic. So you've obviously got very deep roots as a practitioner, but also deep roots as a distance education specialist. How have those practices been changed over the last 20 years or so as a result of the internet?
Well, I think that the real opportunity that has come to us is the simplicity of connectivity that has come with ubiquitous bandwidth and connectivity across all of the space that has been difficult geography to service for distance education in the past, and especially I would say in the developed world where governments have seen the use of bandwidth as an economic development tool. And so we're very much interested in investing in the bandwidth and the nodes for receptivity of internet signals that could be distributed more widely in rural communities. And as wireless became another part of that world, the last mile problems went away. And there was more of an opportunity for everyone to see education as a level playing field. And so distance educators have very much taken advantage of that. But it has been a very small part of the education practice overall. And one of my interests is in working with faculty members, instructors, teachers, to really develop the digital fluency and the mastery over the technology that allows them to teach and support learners in the way that best suits their personal style, beliefs, discipline, all of those things. It's really about empowering educators. And I think that's the next big wave, is how do we empower more educators to use technology effectively in their classrooms in any discipline.
Great. And I think part of the answer there is open education resources, isn't it, which we can get to shortly. And in the meantime, can you tell us a bit about your journey from practitioner to chief executive officer?
So I think I built a reputation in the early days as someone who could get difficult projects completed and outcomes achieved. And so I had the opportunity to be a leader of sorts in institutional practices in universities and in colleges in British Columbia. And at the time, our government was seeing a kind of a gold rush mentality on the part of many of our universities and colleges, everybody building out online learning at the same time and huge duplication of effort occurring. So they decided to create an entity called BC Campus, British Columbia Campus, which would be a unifying body to bring together all of the practitioners and practices and begin to build out a resource network for the province and fund online development in a more managed environment. And so when the opportunity came along for BC Campus to have an executive director, I was one of the candidates for that and was the successful person in the competition and was able to do that job for about 10 years, building out ways of supporting institutions through shared educational services. Do we all have to have a learning management system? Do we all have to manage our own web conferencing services? Can we not work together in a more coordinated and collaborative way and drive down the price for everyone, let them maintain their autonomy, and also collaborate as a kind of network of practitioners who understands innovative and good practice and how to use it in their classroom? So I think we were able to model some great activities during that time period. I was very lucky during that time period to have some receptive people in government when we proposed a government-funded open textbook program for the province of British Columbia in 2012, and government said, yes, proceed.
And those resources are available to anyone around the world, aren't they?
They are. I mean, in the early days, it was a hard sell. Between 2003 and 2012, it was a hard sell for many instructors to think beyond the borders of British Columbia. Like, if the British Columbia government funded this, it should be for British Columbians. And government was thinking the same way. It was only when we showed them the power of collaboration beyond our borders that we could use resources that were created elsewhere that we began to adopt the Creative Commons license in earnest as a universally accepted way of licensing copyright materials for reuse by others. And I think that way of thinking has begun to really take off in higher education particularly.
Yeah. So you mentioned Creative Commons licenses there. Which particular license are you making use of?
We specify that our institutions can choose any license, but we recommend CC BY SA, so Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike. And it is the license that many of our institutions are most comfortable with. Some would like to put a non-commercial license in place, But we have tried to make it as easy to reuse product as possible and allow our institutions to have some comfort that if they created it with public funds for education, it's really used for education and not being converted into something commercial. There is a real worry out there that that is the case, and we have a hard time arguing otherwise with some practitioners who are the kind of engines of innovation who build this material.
Mm. So I guess with openness, there are degrees, aren't there? So CC by SA is a very good open license. CC by SA ND, of course, is much more closed, I suppose, across that spectrum.
Right, it is. And we see very few instances of non-derivative licenses, but where those come into play most often are when we're dealing with culturally sensitive materials, indigenous materials, stories, and things like that. And we think that's a valid perspective. And I know there's a lot of work happening in various parts of the world, including New Zealand, to come up with a better way of thinking about working with our indigenous colleagues and citizens to think about how we can make open materials available, but at the same time, respect the cultural sensitivities of those groups.
Mm, absolutely. So, David, you're obviously a very long-time advocate of open education, and I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the ideas and themes that your work in that area has provided, particularly those that you sense are still pertinent today.
Well, I think the biggest problem with open in the early days was communicating the message effectively, especially the value proposition. It was very easy to communicate a savings value proposition for students who did not have to buy commercially available resources when a similarly available and suitable and peer-reviewed resource existed in the open space. But more recently, we've actually advocated more effectively to instructors who are really starting to understand the value of customizing resources to better meet the learning needs of their students, to the reputational value of making their resource widely available to their peers. And I think one of the things that is little known or not well understood is there is an economy at work in open education, and that is even in programs like ours, where government has invested heavily in open education, they have supplied money which we can pay for the work that practitioners do to create those open licenses. They retain the intellectual property, but they grant us an open license to distribute it widely. It doesn't stop them downstream from taking it to a commercial publisher or anything else they would like to do with respect to publishing or research. And I think it's understanding how to use that economy effectively, which we're getting better at describing. And it's far less difficult these days to attract faculty and instructors to participate in open education projects. And in fact, they're buying in big time here in Ontario right now.
Sounds like a fascinating scheme. So the academics are actually contracted to prepare these resources, which they can later use for their own publications if they choose to.
That's right. Mm. And we think that is a wonderful advantage, because typically in a publishing scheme, you may be paid a small upfront fee and then you depend on royalties through distribution. And I don't know of many faculty that I know personally who are wealthy because of that. And I think the reputational value of others using your resource and seeing it as a stellar resource for the kinds of teaching and discipline use they make of it is really a value proposition that appeals to the hearts and minds of many educators.
Mm, excellent. Can you give us some idea of the scale of what you're actually involved with here at the moment?
Yeah, we have three large projects underway right now, one called Open at Scale Nursing, Open at Scale Business, and Open at Scale Apprenticeship. And we were very fortunate to have our business educators in our college system in Ontario. We have a two-tiered system, colleges and universities. Our college system is aimed more specifically at providing skills that lead to employability. And so our college instructors, our heads of business, our deans of business, asked me to meet with them last year and said, we're hearing about this open idea, and we think it's a really cool idea. how could we work with you to do that at scale so that all of our first year programs could draw upon a common set of resources? Well, that was music to our ears, because that is the way to get to scale quickly when heads of business programs and their instructors see the value in a common set of resources that they can still customize to meet specific needs, or use only parts of that meet their needs, but make those available to students at no cost. Then you have the opportunity to market your programs to students to say there are no resource costs aside from tuition to be a part of this program. They're seeing it as a win-win-win. The same is true in nursing. We're working with the deans of nursing in our university sector to identify common sets of resources that they find are expensive for students, that change quickly, that need to be updated, and we're investing at a central point through our eCampus Ontario program to build those out. So it's curricular resources beyond textbooks that include ancillary materials like slides and test banks and videos and audio productions, and all of the things that they think would be useful to animate and resource business and nursing programs. We know that in nursing, if you get it wrong, people do actually die. So we have to be careful and have an editorial consultant that works with our program to make sure that we're getting precision resources created that meet the needs, that are peer-reviewed by instructors in nursing programs that they know will meet the needs of the challenges they face in the healthcare workspace.
That sounds really excellent. It's almost like the fulfillment of a dream, which I think many have had for about 15 to 20 years, isn't it? The
it
development
is.
Of high-quality open education resources, which can be reused, but we can have every faith in the fact that they've been put together in a very, very robust way.
That's the key. And the flip side is apprenticeship, where students already have some very good curricular resources, but the piece that is really more difficult to resource is the employment situations that apprentices face to actually learn the physical hard skills of the trade or job. And in many cases, they miss parts of that experience because they may be an electrician who works in home building, and most of their experience is in home building, but when they come to be certified, they also need to know about industrial control systems and things they may not have experienced. So we're trying to figure out how to resource the gaps in knowledge or experience that some of these students may have, and to reinforce them with animated materials that allow them to test their skills with simulations, as well as real-world experiences. So they have the opportunity to review, they have the opportunity to see something before they actually see it in the field, and it gives them the opportunity to have a very rounded field experience.
Brilliant. David, I'm going to cut into some practice now. So under a CC by SA license, any adjustment to an open education resource has to be shared alike. So any changes you make must also be made available to the wider open community. How does that actually work in the case of what you're talking about there? So if a business lecturer decides to customize the textbook to some extent, how is that then shared on?
So one of the things that we have also built out for the province of Ontario is an open digital library. You can go to openlibrary.ecampusontario.ca and you'll see our open library and you can search it. We've also put in place the publishing infrastructure that allows instructors to download the existing textbooks or resources, clone them electronically, and then make their own revised versions. Our system is built to have revision control so that we know that we have revisions to the resources. And so we're trying to improve that process now. We don't expect to see a lot of that initially, but we do expect to see it over time. So we're working on revision control so that people will know that the resource that is available to them has four or five different versions, and it would give you the chance to actually sample each of the versions through that digital library, and you can do that now, and then decide which one you'd like to use. And if you want to customize it yourself, you can. our hope with the essay license is that people will put it back. And one of the key recruits to support our programs are librarians in all of our institutions who are part of our Open Ranger network for Ontario. And we have a whole cadre of librarians who do that work. And so working with them, we're building out these systems so that they're more robust and more manageable.
Hmm. David, it's now mid-2019. Your observations about online learning and education at the present time, what are some of the key themes that you see out there at the moment?
Well, it's growing quickly. We just contributed financial support to a national survey of online learning in Canada, and the results are published on our website, and we had an 80% response rate from all of the institutions across Canada. Mm. And we're seeing that more than two-thirds of Canadian post-secondary institutions offer online courses for credit. And 8% of all of our course registrations in Canada currently in higher education are online. So things are starting to grow quickly. But like any system or technology, there are probably some limits to growth. And we don't know what those are yet, but what we're seeing is growth, and we're beginning to think about other questions we'd like to ask in our research, like what are the discipline areas where most of these resources and online courses exist, and are there gaps, and which are those courses, and why are there gaps there? One of the biggest findings from the study was that the greatest barrier to participation in online learning for institutions in Canada is insufficient training for faculty to develop or support or conduct courses that have online components. So a lot of our effort that we're gearing up is gearing up towards working with faculty to give them the skills and resources to establish more confidence as well as control over the environments in which they teach.
So when you say online, is that online only, or is it a combination of blended or flipped classroom?
That's the other part of the issue, is that one of the things that we tested in this last time out was a set of definitions that would help us to segment the populations that do different kinds or different versions of online learning: hybrid, blended, fully online. And the stats I gave you were for fully online courses. 8% of all course registrations are fully online. We expect that it's higher across the country because many courses have some functionality online for any course, including a face-to-face course. So refining those definitions and getting better data from universities and colleges is a big part of our effort as we build out surveys on subsequent years. Our colleagues in the United States have been surveying since around 2002 at a national level on an annual basis. And so their survey systems are somewhat more robust than ours now in the way in which they collect data. So the National Survey Group, Canadian Digital Learning Research Association, has been trying to meet with ministries of education in each of our provinces. Education is a provincial affair in Canada, not federal. And so they've been meeting to actually get to some common definitions that would allow student information systems where students register for courses to begin to collect the data in an automatic way so that we have a much more analytical approach going forward.
Excellent. David, imagine you had an unlimited research budget. What would you do with it? What is the research you'd most like to see done at the moment?
Well, I think the research that we really need to do is on the professional opportunities and expertise of our faculty and instructors. We know that researchers, particularly instructors in the university sector, come into their profession through a research background. They don't come in through a teaching background. So the question is, what are the most effective ways to skill up our instructors to be fully competent and confident in these environments and have a real professional presence online? How do we do that? And how do we help them to acquire the agency and the digital fluency to be able to work more effectively in the online space. Because I think what we also need to check on through research is student engagement with online learning and the relative successes that they may be having. But the same is true in the classroom. Like, no one actually does that about success in face-to-face teaching. And there's always these false dichotomies about, well, is e-learning better than face-to-face? Well, let's actually level the playing field on that and begin to look at the skills that faculty bring to the game and how they effectively use those in each of those different teaching environments, because they are different, and you do need a different set of skills to be effective in the online space.
Yeah, absolutely. So just coming back to your previous distance education heritage, typically course resources will be developed centrally by a pool of experts, possibly working with a member of faculty. But now in the online world, of course, there's every opportunity for faculty to become more directly involved with the complete distance experience. So in suggesting that we focus on instructors and upskilling them, does that include their ability to prepare courses, basically to cover the entire TPAC range of expertise?
Yes. And in fact, one of the things that drives me in my work is to empower faculty to make those decisions. Over time, a lot of the decisions about the delivery systems associated with online learning have kind of moved in the direction of chief information officers and technologists. And I'm not sure that's the right way to go. I think faculty need to be very fluent in how to set up a learning environment that best suits their discipline and the learning needs of their students. I think that's their call. And I think instructional designers have a role in facilitating that discussion. But I think faculty know their work as well as anyone, and they should be far more empowered to do that work.
Great.
I'm sorry, there's a fire alarm going off in my building here.
Okay. If you do need to go, just
I think we're okay. No,
okay.
I think we're okay. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, that's all right. So, David, can you suggest two people you'd recommend as leaders of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you perhaps at the moment, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we've built out is a set of resources that we call Ontario Extend, built on six principles and attributes that we believe all instructors should have as they move forward in the 21st century. Be a teacher, not just to teach, but a teacher for learning and understanding the connection. To be a scholar who actively researches their own teaching. And to be a curator, a collaborator, an experimenter, a technologist. These attributes are all part of the new mix of skills that instructors need. And our colleague at the University of British Columbia, Simon Bates, proposed this six attributes of a 21st century educator maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And we asked Simon if we could further develop that activity out. And he had CC licensed it. So we took it a little further and have built out a complete online learning program that is self-directed, MOOC-based, can incorporate it into a learning management system. It's got a lot of flex and scope. It's badged. It has a badged environment to go with it based on a portfolio-based competencies. So Simon is a great thinker in this area, and we've been very grateful to build out his idea in Ontario and make it go big. We're actually operating a MOOC right now to make it available more broadly. So it's a very interesting way to think about digital fluency and the attributes that instructors need. And Simon Bates, who's a very clear thinker on these ideas at the University of British Columbia, would be a great person to speak with. And another colleague, Dr. Valerie Lopes at Seneca College here in Toronto, is very interested in digital literacy and digital fluency in the student body. Because these ideas about digital natives are not something she deeply believes, because she's worked very closely with students and finds that their skills with the technology tend to be fairly surface level skills. And whenever they're asked to do things more deeply using the technology or to think about it more deeply, they have no framework to help analyze their own knowledge or skills. And so her interest in developing digital fluency at scale for students in the context of the programs that they're taking is a really interesting way of looking at how we upskill our students from a literacy perspective. The other work that we follow is some really early work that was done in the 70s here in Toronto at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education by Alan Tuff. He wrote a book called The Adults Learning Projects, which really built on the notion of self-directed learning, but also the need to actually practically do something as a self-directed learner to produce an output, almost like a portfolio that demonstrates your learning. And that, to me, is very closely related to the work of Laban Wenger in Situated Learning and Collins Duguid and John Seely Brown's work in Cognitive Apprenticeship. And much of that work is the work that really guides our thinking about how we get at digital fluency with students and how we get at digital fluency with instructors. And it's that research that we're currently doing and have just published a paper on that.
Brilliant. Well, I certainly hope to link to that from our website. David, it's been, as I mentioned earlier, a real privilege talking with you. I've learned a lot about open education and your activities over there in Ontario. I certainly do wish you all the best. It sounds as though you're doing some very good cutting-edge work there in terms of developing high-quality resources with open licenses. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks so much, Mark. Pleasure talking to you.
You can learn more about David and his work from our website. His Twitter handle is Dendroglyph. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website www.onlinelearninglegends.com to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.